Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 305, and I'm excited because we have some selected clips from the New York City live show that happened this past weekend. It was a ton of fun. It really was. And we can't wait for the next one. And I want to say also the Platinum Night and the VIP stuff, that was every bit as fun as I thought it would be. It was super cool to speak to you all and enjoy some drinks and some food and some hangout time and all that stuff. But that said, let's get on over to the show. And I will say this as well. We are going to do an additional segment for our patrons. Now, you're going to hear some stuff from the live show. Now, the patrons will get a very fun game, which was me turning the tables on Andrew a little bit and giving him Thomas's bar exam revenge, which was some bar questions based on a little something called Earth Law and that kind of thing. It was a big hit in the live show. It was a ton of fun. That'll be available for patrons in the patron-only cut. For everybody here, though, there's plenty to enjoy. So why don't we hop on over to that live show?
The jury's like, oh, snap, a twist. Like, they love twists. Any great trial has a twist.
Suggest that we give him 10 years and Leavenworth or 11 years and 12 words.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take 5 and 10 in Woolworth.
Well, it was like this, Mr. Court.
Address the judge as your honor.
Well, it was like this, my honor.
Your honor, not my honor.
Why? Don't you like him?
Meant to come down here and defend me against these characters, and the only one I've got on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
So I've got the suspenders to hold up your belt, right? And then in the case these fall down, though, I have another suspender to hold that up. So I should be the lawyer now.
Yeah.
Okay.
By bar rules.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to our first ever live show. I'm so excited to be here. Okay, I don't think I can keep this. Okay. Wow. I don't know about you, but I am feeling a little bit last night's partying. We had so much hookers and flapjacks, and it's really the flapjacks that's doing it, actually. Everything else was fine, but the flapjacks, they're heavy. They're heavy.
Yeah.
No, thanks to our platinum attendees. That was a lot of fun. All right. Well, I think we're going to get into it.
Are we ready to get started?
Yeah. If you've noticed, folks in the VIP and Platinum have your little placards. That's going to be used for voting for different things and for Optimus Prime versus Negatron later. So hope you didn't already throw those away.
All right. That would be very Negatron to have thrown them away already.
Yeah, I think I win in that case. I would say we're going to get to it. I think I'm excited. We've got, I think, a good balance of good old-fashioned deep to, well, shallow dives.
Yeah.
I guess, and some fun and games so that it's not just a lecture from a law talking guy. Special
no
delivery.
No one wants that.
Let's do a bar question. What do you think?
I think that sounds like a lot of fun. And we have one of our Platinum Night winners.
Yeah.
It's going to play along. And if you are in Platinum or VIP section, you hold up your little placard to vote for which answer you want. So,
all right.
As always, play along with Thomas for the integrity of the game. We do not guess until Thomas has had a chance to work everything out.
Someone with a clear memory of last night's event should tell us who was the winner. Oh, come here. Yeah, come on down. Woo! Okay. Have we met?
Oh, yeah.
So many flapjacks. So many flapjacks. Say your name and rank
Kareem.
And serial number.
Oh. Kareem.
Hi, Kareem. Do you have a Patreon name you want to shout out or anything? You can.
I'm not a patron.
Okay. That's good. That's fine.
That we knew that. That was just to shame Kareem.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Why aren't you? No, this is just an intervention to get you. All right. Well, do we have it? Let's do it. Oh, here we go. T3BE.
Oh,
all right. I am going to read it.
It's up here.
All right. You wanna just... I'll turn around. Why don't I just turn around and read it? All right. Thomas, at a civil trial for slander, the plaintiff showed that defendant had called her a thief. In defense, the defendant called a witness to testify, "I've been the plaintiff's neighbor for many years, and people in the community generally have said she's a thief." Is the testimony concerning the plaintiff's reputation admissible? A, no, because character is an essential element of the offense and must be proven by specific instances of conduct. B, yes, to prove that the plaintiff is a thief and to reduce or refute the damages claimed. C, yes, to prove the plaintiff is a thief but not on damages. Or D, yes, to reduce or refute the damages claimed, but not to prove that the plaintiff is a thief.
Oh, nice easy one. Thanks. I think, should we let him cheat off of my answer, or should we have him, like, give you his answer?
We could sequester him. I mean, he's not a patron,
Yeah,
cares?
I know.
I have rights.
I will be very little help to you on this question. All right. Brian, I'm going to just stare at this for 15 minutes of silence, and then can you edit that into work? Okay, so this sounds like a hearsay thing, right? Kind of, maybe. Civil trial for slander, though, which is interesting. My first instinct was, this seems hearsay-y, so they could never allow this. But then I thought about it, and I was like, well, if your trial is about slander, and say I call Andrew, like, Andrew's suspenders aren't terrible, and he sues me for slander, and then I'm like,
which I would.
Yeah, which you would. And I'm like, well, truth isn't perfect defense of... No.
Which it is.
But if I find evidence that, like, look, everybody knows his suspenders are not as good as mine. Like, that's common knowledge around the village or whatever the hell it was. So, like, how much damage could I have done to you by just echoing what everybody already says? That's my thought process. Let's see if any answers fit that. No, because character is an essential element of the offense and must be proven by specific instances. Yes, to prove the plaintiff is a thief. Yeah, that doesn't seem right. C, yes, to prove the plaintiff is a thief, but not on damages. So if I'm going to second chance this, here's what's reaching out to me is answer D. Yes, to reduce or refute the damages claim, but not to prove the plaintiff is a thief. That makes sense to me. So you wouldn't prove they're a thief by, like, proving that some people have said they're a thief. That doesn't make sense. But I think it would make sense to be like, how much damage did I really cause your reputation, Andrew, when everybody already knows your suspenders suck? It's already taken a toll on your career already. So how much did I do? So D is, I think, going to be my final answer. If I were to Thomas's second chance it, I would say that maybe, like, A, because it's the one no answer. Like, I'll go between A or D, and I'll final answer D. That's what I think. Well, what do you think?
Oh, jeez. All right, let's see. Okay. Strategically, I'm going to agree with whatever Thomas just said.
I think that's the opposite of strategic, actually.
No, we either tie.
Every single lawyer that we bring on almost always does this, because either we both get it wrong and whatever, they can be like, oh, that bar is so hard, yeah. Or, like, we get it right, and then we're like, yep, you got it right. But if a lawyer, they almost never guess a different answer, because if the risk that they're wrong and I'm right, they would have to fold up shop. Like, yeah. No amount of suspenders could get you back from that. So what do you think? You going with my answer?
And the second reason is because your analysis was...
Oh, spot on, spot on. Okay, thank you very much. Let's.
Notice that your analysis was his second reason.
Why should we vote? Let's see what the crowd thinks.
Absolutely, all right. We're going to vote. Okay.
If you think it is A, hold up your placards. Okay, 2, 3, 4, 7, 3 votes.
Yeah.
Okay, you as not
including,
a patron,
including
you can contribute labor to us by counting for us.
Okay. And I want to point out, including actual lawyer Jeff Blackwell.
Ooh.
Now,
well, that makes me feel nervous. You just went against everything I just said in the yes. Yep. Okay, so we got three A's. How many think it's B? We got someone without a placard, but that's okay. Yeah. We'll give you that. How many think it's C? Oh, you sheeple. Okay, there's one. These
sheeple
are so swayed by my analysis. How many people think it's my brilliantly reasoned, good-looking answer? That's a lot of people. I don't really feel like counting that.
It's definitely more.
That's higher than I've ever been required to count.
15.
So, okay, yeah. All right, well, analysis time?
All right, so here's the analysis. This question is combining two important principles here. The first is that it is a trial for slander. And again, this is one of the things I love about the show is, right, Thomas's kind of jokey, like, hey, everybody knows your suspenders suck. That's actually an important part of understanding this question, right, which is understanding a person's reputation obviously does speak to the damages with respect to an argument for slander, right? So then the question is, can you also prove the underlying offense by talking to somebody's character? And this is Rule 405 of the Federal Rules of Evidence.
Why didn't you know that, dummy?
Right.
I don't want to make you look bad.
That's an important second chance strategy here. So, Federal Rule 405, I have brought this up. I don't have Federal Rule 405 memorized. Says, when evidence of a person's character or character trait is admissible, it may be proved by testimony about the person's reputation or by testimony in the form of an opinion. 405B relates to specific instances of conduct, which says when a person's character or character trait is an essential element of a charge, claim, or defense, the character trait may also be proved by relevant specific instances of the person's conduct. So when you put those together, that means the correct answer is the one nobody in the room picked. Answer B, yes, to prove the plaintiff is a thief, and also to reduce or refute the damages claim. I want to say this. This is an exceptionally hard question. I chose this because it was next in line and because it's short. But this is an exceptionally hard question, and I think
hold
D
on,
is a really, really
on,
attractive answer.
Hold on. Well, the winner is Jeff Blackwell, right? Is that?
No, Jeff picked A. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got that wrong. Spoken like a true lawyer. Yeah,
I was just gonna say.
I have some questions. I have concerns. I have concerns, Andrew Torres. Do you mean to tell me? And I'm gonna hiss these concerns at you. Do you mean to tell me that if we want to prove in a trial, does it have to be a slander trial or like any trial? If the prosecutor is like, oh yeah, Andrew Torres did it. You know why? Lots of people in the neighborhood say he's a thief. Like what?
So. The crucial issue here is whether the plaintiff's character is, quote, in issue, is an essential element of the claim or defense under the substantive law, right? So here, the defendant is saying, it's true, right? Yeah, I called you a thief. It's true. Everybody thinks you're a thief. That their reputation is an essential element of the element of slander. So no, you can't just introduce...
Only when it's slander.
Yeah. You can't... Well, not just when it's slander. It is whenever character is an element of the specific claim or defense.
All right, I lose. So. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
I don't know.
Yeah. So Kareem's question, if you didn't hear that, is, are there cases in which D is correct? And the answer to that is not only yes, but the overwhelming majority of crimes, of civil lawsuits, of claims, D is going to be correct. I got to tell you, if I were taking this question cold, I think I would have gone for D. D is the classic... Well, case of how you handle
it. I think we should have a Viking funeral for my suspenders.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for playing. Person. We appreciate you. Good job.
Kareem.
Man. That bar. Sometimes you get the bar, and sometimes the bar gets you, man. It's just how it goes.
Bill Barr.
You know, I feel the appropriate amount warmed up now. Because I did have the overwarm up like an armature, and now I'm good. Are we ready for the actual place that was supposed to be? Okay, here's what we'll do. The audience does breaking, and I do down, and you do the law, breaking down the law. Let's see if you can do it. Ready? Okay. Dun, dun, dun.
Breaking
down.
The law.
Down.
Down.
The law. Breaking.
Down.
The law.
Down.
The law.
Down.
The law.
All right, we did it!
Yay! Nice job.
Every musician in the audience just had a collective stroke and died, but that's okay.
Everybody who does karaoke just was like, "Oh, that was fantastic."
Well, we can cut to the chase. We can do our shallow dive, our mini dive, without technology. But hopefully it'll come back because that'll be bad. But that's okay. the later half of the show, we'll need that computer. Okay, let's do it. Today's mini deep shallow kind of dive. It's on gun control. And now, as a keen political observer, I'm starting to wonder if the nothing we're doing isn't going to work. So I wonder... is nothing a good answer? Question one. And then also, I hear... rumors that the Supreme Court could take care of this for us, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're troubled by us doing nothing, and you're thinking that passing laws is probably not going to happen, maybe the...
Depends on how many of Mitch McConnell's shoulders we can injure.
Right. Maybe the Supreme Court will step in. I know that. That was a good hiss there. That was meant to be a little bit of a laugh line. The last time we passed a law relating to guns was 2005. You might remember 2005, and so if you're sitting there thinking like 55 Republicans in the Senate and George W. Bush, so of course that law was terrible, right? That law was called, and I'm not making this up, the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. It was the number one legislative priority for the National Rifle Association. It passed the House 283-144. That's with 60 Democratic votes. I'm going to lose more patrons on this, but that included then-Representative Bernie Sanders.
Oh.
Yeah. It passed the Senate 65-31 with 14 Democratic votes, but a lot of, like, you know, Democrats from red states. It's going to lose more patrons here. Joe Biden voted against it. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I remember in the debates between Hillary and Bernie, they tried to make an issue of this. Was it this very vote where he was saying, I guess the argument was, why are we punishing a company that makes a product that we've decided is fine? Like everybody, every, you know, adult and child in this country should have a gun at all times.
Yeah.
What's the logic of, you know, do you find that argument compelling or no?
I don't find that argument compelling because it misstates what happened, right? Oh. So...
Well, like most of my arguments. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That was indeed the Bernie Sanders defense. It did relate to this law. This is a terrible law, and I'm about to explain why. The purpose of this law, I'm going to read from it directly, is, quote, to prohibit civil liability actions from being brought or continued against manufacturers, distributors, dealers, or importers of firearms or ammunition for damages, injunctive, or other relief resulting from the misuse of their products by others. And so the important thing that responds to the argument that Bernie Sanders gave that Thomas just reiterated, it's not Thomas's argument, it's not his fault, is it has to be a lawsuit anyway, right? Like, in other words, if the defense is I'm using the product as it is intended, that's a defense in the civil trial, right? What this was meant to do was, and did, as soon as the law passed, it said, you can't bring lawsuits against gun manufacturers, and all current lawsuits then pending were dismissed.
Wow.
Yeah. So what happened was this law is a super short law, and it has a couple different sections in it. It's 15 U.S.C. 7901. I always say this on the show, and I envision people like listening at the computer and like,
oh yeah, Googling. They're gonna write that down. I think most people are driving and listening, and they actually pull over and they 16. Yeah.
Opening arguments is fantastic.
They open their trunk, yeah. They got a bunch of law books, and they're like, what did he say, 16? Yeah.
For those of you with 97-minute commutes listening in the car. Thank you. So, three sections. 7901 has all of these legislative findings, and it says garbage like, Congress finds the following, that the Second Amendment to the United States provides that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But by the way, the Second Amendment doesn't say that. I mean, half of it says that, but you know that there's an introductory clause that ought to have meaning. It doesn't. So anyway, put a pin in that.
So they tried to pass a law version of half of the Second Amendment?
Yes, okay. That is 100% what they did. So the first part is just the congressional finding. Put a pin in that. We'll come back to it. Section 7902. So 7902 is the immunity section, and then 7903 has all of the definitions in it, right? So 7903 defines the kinds of lawsuits that are prohibited, and it's defined really, really expansively. It says, any proceeding brought by any person against a manufacturer or seller or a trade association, gee, I wonder why that's in there, for damages resulting from the criminal or unlawful misuse of the product, right? So that's how it's defined. But there's an exception. And the exception, and the relevant one for this case, is it does not apply to an action in which the manufacturer or seller of a qualified product, that's the legal euphemism for gun, knowingly violated a state or federal statute, quote, applicable to the sale or marketing of the product, end of quote. And so here's what happened. After Sandy Hook in 2012, parents in Newtown, Connecticut sued Remington. Remington manufactures the AR-15. If we have the slide.
Oh, my God. No, we don't have that
slide. Oh, all right. We could
not
all,
even with a working computer do we have that slide.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. We could all line up and file past my Commodore 64, and I could show you. The Remington.
Oh, just send it to the printer.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be dot matrixing in the way back. So
it'll be done printing by the time the show's over, and then. Yeah.
So let me describe this Remington ad for you here. Thomas is going to look at it, right?
Okay.
It features the AR-15, and the tagline is, and I swear to God, I'm not making this up, forces of opposition bow down. So that kind of seems like that's in pretty bad taste, given that that's what Adam Lanza had his victims do in the Newtown shooting. So the parents decided that they were going to sue Remington for running this ad, right? For saying, hey, we got a product that you can use to make people bow down. Like, that's not really a legal, right? Like, that does not seem to comport with the self-defense use of a firearm or hunting, right? Forces of opposition, make the squirrels bow down, right? So,
What are the chances that whoever made that ad also has like the metal truck scrotum on their truck?
Yeah.
It's probably like 99%. Yeah, I would say.
Yeah, that's a truck nuts guy right here. Yeah, absolutely. And so the lawsuit was about, could they sue Remington under that exception, right? Is there a law that is, quote, applicable to the sale or marketing of the product? And in Connecticut, they said, there is a law, right? And that law is the Connecticut Uniform Unfair Trade Practices Act, or CUTPA, just like the abbreviation. And this is a general statute, right, that says you can sue people for false or deceptive advertising, right? And so what the trial court had to do was figure out, hey, does this statute, the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, does that count as a statute that is, quote, applicable to the sale or marketing of the product, right? And the arguments back and forth went like this. The parents suing Remington said, well, it's a law, and it applies to everything, and guns are a part of an everything. I'm 100%, I mean, like, that's basically what the brief says, right? So it should fall under the exception. And Remington argued the opposite. They said, look, we get it that it says applicable, and applicable could be defined expansively, but if you say any law that doesn't specifically mention guns qualifies under the exception, then basically this law, this giveaway to the gun industry, means nothing, right? Like, everything is going to be an exception to it. Does that make sense?
I'm just waiting for the part where the court screws us. Can you get to that part?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So here's what happened, right? The trial court...
I have to,
court,
like, prepare my disappointment so I... Because we're all so disappointed every day that I have to, like, get the energy. Oh, no, the Supreme Court! And then that's all I got. That's all I can...
Well, this was a state lawsuit, right?
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah.
So it goes first to the Connecticut State Trial Court, which grants Remington's motion to dismiss. And they say, yeah, look, like, I'm sorry, we don't like it, but there was this 2005 law. It grants immunity from lawsuits. There's no way we can read the exception as including unfair trade practices. That, because every state has one of those, and now we could bring all the kinds of lawsuits that are not supposed to be brought, right? The intermediate appellate court affirmed, but the Connecticut State Supreme Court, 4-3, reversed. And they said, look, you guys are, there were two parts of the ruling that are relevant. The first was, and both of these feel like the Connecticut, the four justices and the majority on the Connecticut Supreme Court, feels like they hate Antonin Scalia as much as I do, right? Because the entire first section is, hey, look, like, it's the question is the plain meaning of the word applicable, and applicable means applies to, and this law applies to, so, get out of here with that. And by the way, like, all of the speculative questions about, like, well, maybe they'll bring lots of other lawsuits, I don't know, deal with that in a different case, but, like, this is a very narrowly tailored lawsuit, right? Like, it is consistent with the original 2005 law to say, oh, we're stopping you from bringing, right, like, the same kinds of products liability, unreasonably dangerous, the same kinds of lawsuits that were raised against the tobacco industry, for example, right? So this would still grant you immunity from that. It would authorize a narrow kind of set of claims. And, you know, we'll deal with the exploding problem later. Seems like it's a pretty well-thought-out opinion. And it's the Connecticut State Supreme Court, so, you know, Brett Kavanaugh's not on it, right?
Is this like the... is this going to be like the abortion thing where you thought the state could, like, get around the Supreme Court by doing this, or no?
I've kind of set you up for that. So no. And here's why, right? Because what happened in the Kansas abortion case was the Kansas Supreme Court found more expansive rights under the Kansas state constitution and said, we no longer have to read this in peri materia in the same way as the Supreme Court reads the 14th Amendment. We're going to say it's more expansive than that. Here, the question is the interpretation of a federal statute, right? This 2005 law, and ultimately, the final arbiter. State courts can determine what federal laws mean. Remington has filed a petition for cert to the Supreme Court. That won't be ruled upon until the fall term. The Supreme Court gets to take a little break for the summer. It's fun. I think the Supreme Court will grant cert in this case because most courts that have interpreted the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act have interpreted it the other way, have said, no, that exception has to be read really, really narrowly. It doesn't include statutes like unfair trade practices. So the Supreme Court is going to take this up. This is my prediction. They're going to take this up to resolve that conflict among the circuits. And we know where this Supreme Court is headed. So,
oh. Oh,
so good news,
Court.
Everybody.
Yeah. Is there the chance, though, to maybe try to get state laws written that could frame it in a way of, like, we're granting people who want to sue more rights, and to make it kind of parallel to that abortion idea?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Well, get on it. Are any of you states? Do we have any states in the crowd? Yeah. If we do...
I want to talk to you about gerrymandering while we're there.
If any of you live in a state, which is not everybody, but if anybody lives in a state, get on that. Yeah, yep. Figure it out. We don't have to do anything. We just tell you what's wrong, and then you do it. Okay.
So obviously, this story I don't think is going to end happily, and you know I try and make sure that the show is not a funereal death march every week. Mm. Sometimes I succeed.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Okay, well, that leaves us some extra time, I think, for Q&A, right?
Yeah.
Hey. All right. That's going to require you folks to have questions. And I will. Here, I'll be the. What, Mike? Is this a show where somebody goes up in the thing? I don't watch TV. Sorry. I watch stuff on Netflix. Anyway, who? Okay. Here we go. How much reach do I have? Oh, we should turn on the transformer effect. All right. Yeah. Question.
You're right.
I'm sorry.
The first question.
You're so right. I apologize for that error. Here you go. Question one, as always, from Teresa Gomez. Here you go.
Actually, I have one.
Fruity Pebbles.
As Teresa, she has diplomatic immunity from me ribbing her for taking too long, so I'm not going to.
Okay, this is for Thomas. So it's how did you develop your interview style? And have any famous interviewers influenced how you ask questions or prepare for interviews?
That's an awesome question.
Oh, I'm going to give the most disappointing of answers, which is nothing. Like literally, I just did a podcast and was like, I want to talk to a person. And then when I want to talk to somebody, most of the time, unless something goes horribly wrong, most of the time they're an interesting person who I just want to know something from. And so I do it that way. I usually try to have a certain amount ahead of time that you have to learn how to visualize how the whole thing's going to go and like try to just gently steer where it's going to go. But it's all very experimental, you know, like it and editing kind of fixes it. But it really, I personally admire Ezra Klein the most, but I actually started listening to him way after I started interviewing. So I don't think he's like an influence, but he's like my favorite in terms of interviewing. But thank you for that. What I try to do is make sure that the conversation's interesting. And if I do a good job, then it is interesting. And if I don't do a good job, then people cancel. Yeah. And then that's how it goes. Thank you. Okay. Real question number two. Here we go. All right. Wait. So I got to go back to Jeff. There you go.
This is a question for Andrew. And I'm trying to word it in the form of a question. Given
is this a rant? I could sit down.
Given that slandering someone with accusing them of being a thief, hang on.
This is awesome.
Hang on. Given that accusing someone of being a thief is accusing them of being accusing them of criminal acts and therefore defamation per se, they don't have to prove damages. So showing that she has a reputation as being a thief doesn't matter, and B and D should be incorrect regardless.
So,
question is, hold on, let me just repeat the question. The question is, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's the question. Yeah.
So I still think the answer to that is no, and here's why. Jeff is 100% right in the predicate to his question that
the bar exam is rigged.
Yes.
Thank you.
That accusing someone of a crime of moral turpitude is defamation per se, and so as an element, you do not have to prove damages. However, the court can still award damages. It's not statutory damages. So in other words, damages will still, the quantification of those damages will still be at issue in that lawsuit. And having testimony introduced that, hey, look, people call this person a thief all the time. Like, what, you know, how can that possibly hurt them in any way whatsoever? You wouldn't dismiss out the lawsuit for failure to prove damages, but the defendant is still very likely to want to introduce evidence to show that that those damages are as small as possible. So, good, nice try, though. I really love
it. Andrew, I hate to say it, but that's a good explanation. We got it wrong. We got it wrong. All right, let's go right here.
Hi. Forced arbitration clauses are becoming increasingly common in employment contracts, materially all contracts. And I've heard they're, like, way worse for the consumer or individual than the corporation. Can you talk to that a little bit about why that is, and also what we can do to reduce them?
That's a fantastic question, and I could literally do an entire episode. I think we have done an episode on it. But let me talk about a couple of things here. So the first thing, and this is almost always absent from any discussion of arbitration clauses, and it's the thing you need to know in the background, and that is our courts are drastically overworked and underfunded. We could double the federal judiciary right now, and every federal... let's not do it right now. we could double the federal judiciary under Liz Warren in 2021, and our judges would still be tragically overworked, right? So every judge I know, right, Jeff's nodding his head, right? Every judge I know has many, many more cases on their docket than they can possibly take. And so courts uniformly have been pro-arbitration, and that thing to know in the background is because it's super easy, because it gets cases off their docket, right? So keep that in mind in sort of the background. Now, I have sometimes been accused of being contradictory on this issue, so I want to be really, really clear.
Are you going to make yourself very clear?
Yes, I'm going to be clear.
Do you like being perfectly clear?
I do like being clear. I am in favor. Like in my day-to-day law practice, I represent small businesses, right? And I think, and in a great many of those contracts, we put arbitration clauses. And the reason that we do that is because that's a massive deterrent to litigation. The average small business, my average client, just having a lawsuit filed against them would be disastrous, right? Like it's a five-figure sum to just begin to answer and move to dismiss, right? Like it's just... It's time consuming. We bill by the hour, and it takes hours to like write stuff out. So I think that among parties with relatively even bargaining power, it makes sense to have arbitration clauses, right? So my small business clients who are B2B with other small businesses, look, that's not Microsoft and the consumer, right? Those are people who go in, who exchange contracts back and forth, and you say, Let's stick an arbitration clause here so that if this goes south, we don't wind up suing each other and the only person who makes any money is me, right? So I defend arbitration clauses in those contexts. The converse is when it is grossly disproportionate in terms of bargaining power. Click on a click wrap agreement for, software, right? You can't activate the program until you click on it, right?
I was going to ask a follow-up kind of related to this, which is there anything the average person can do about this? Or is it just we are stuck with whatever the corporate overlords tell us and we have to like it? Or is there anything we can know or look out for that could help us with this? Or is it just a problem that we have almost no power other than some policy solution to like not, or more judges or whatever it is?
So... it's mostly that, right? Mostly there's nothing you can do about it. But, one of the things, I've said this on the show before, like one of the common aphorisms that every lawyer will give you is the pigs get fat but hogs get slaughtered, right? And the idea behind that is, demand as much as you possibly can with a straight face, but when you go that next step, eventually, like, the common sense aspect of the law is going to rein that in. And we may be getting there with end-user licensing agreements and things like that, right? Like, it's possible that there's so much overreach that a court may come back and go, look, people don't read these things, and we've drawn this arbitrary distinction between, and we've talked about this before, between browse-wrap agreements, which are generally non-enforceable, and click-wrap agreements, where you have to check the box, which are generally enforceable. And I could see a court, like, taking into account evidence and saying, look, the statistical evidence is overwhelming that people just click that box. They never read it. They never bring it up. There's no informed, you know, consent.
Do even you, as a belt and suspenders lawyer, do you read those? Or do you just
no.
No. Yeah, no, one reads, no one's.
But again,
if Andrew Torres, document lover extraordinaire, doesn't read them, then nobody does. I rest my case. That would be how I would...
Here's why I don't read them, right? Because there's not a goddamn thing I can do about it, right? Like, I read stuff when I can do things about it, and, like, Microsoft doesn't care what I think about it, so, yeah. Why should I read their stuff?
Great question. Yeah. Well, here we go. We'll stick with our platinum crowd. Are you going to insult the show by saying you're not a paper? No.
So I want to actually follow up on the arbitration question, because I got the impression that you're speaking very much in pro of it, but there's a lot of problems with arbitration specifically. There's a lot less due process, even under New York statute. But one of the things that stood out to me that you were saying was it saves costs, that the motion to dismiss is going to cost five figures. They're still paying you to do the arbitration.
So... yeah, and I'm really glad you asked the follow-up question, because I feel like I lost that thread a little bit. So let me explain a couple of those things. So number one, the one thing I disagree with is I don't know that arbitration has less due process than an ordinary civil lawsuit. Particularly before the AAA, which is the largest arbitration body, the procedure, most of their arbitrators are retired judges, and basically what it is it's like privatizing a trial, right? It's like a trial where you pay the judge. In addition, under the Federal Arbitration Act, which is 9 U.S.C. Section 1, one of the only grounds for overturning an arbitration award is that the arbitration panel failed to consider relevant evidence, right? So arbitrators tend to err on the side of admitting as much evidence in as possible. So I'm not sure that it's an inherently worse process, but it is that the fact that what you're doing is it's like having a trial where the parties also have to pay the judge. As a result of that, arbitration is much more expensive to initiate, and this is the reason why they do it, right? And this is why why Microsoft puts in mandatory arbitration clauses, and also it's relevant to my small business clients. The average plaintiff's contingent fee lawyer will not take a case that has an arbitration clause. They will file a lawsuit for you, right? So plaintiff's contingency fee lawyers means you don't have to pay. The lawyer takes a percentage of the recovery. And so those lawyers will represent you in disputes in certain cases. They almost never take cases that involve arbitration because of all the upfront costs. So that's when I say it's a deterrent to litigation, primarily my view on that is it's a deterrent to individual plaintiffs who could otherwise run out and talk to a plaintiff's contingent fee lawyer and get a lawsuit filed without having to pay any upfront money. Now you have to pay upfront money. And increased barriers to entry are sometimes good, sometimes bad. So that's what I meant.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and say no more arbitration talk out any of you. I don't want to hear another word about it. Let's go over here.
I'm an Australian citizen resident in the US. What do you see as the legal or political or otherwise path towards sensible gun control?
Woo! Thomas, you want to weigh in?
Yeah,
on
should I turn on Negatron? Yeah. Yeah, the path is there is no path. No, well, you know, it's funny. The House has tried to pass some messaging bills, including was it a background check one? And it's funny because it made it really hilarious that Trump was like, these Democrats won't do anything. I'm going to do some background check stuff. And they're like, you can sign the bill. We did it already. And so that was funny. But I think it's going to take winning back control. That's always... I mean, we might get something... Like, the problem is so bad that if enough of these shootings happen on the same weekend, then, like, the coverage isn't... This is so bizarre. These shootings are every day, but if there's some visible ones in a row enough, then Republicans will be like, okay... Only
ban video games.
Yeah, exactly. They'll be like only 98 rounds instead of 100, and then that's all I think will happen until we win control. What do you think?
Yeah, can I ask you a question as well? Because my understanding from Australia, I mean, this is how I was in Sydney.
Yeah, can I ask you a question? How do you do government over there? Yeah. Can we? anybody write this down? Can somebody write this down? Yes, I say that all the time. Ah, thank you. Yep. Let's do that.
But no. So I have been told by my Australian friends that essentially you had one like school shooting 20 years ago, and then like members of every political party got together and was like, "Well, let's make sure that never happens again," right? Like,
Brian, you got your clown horn? Oh. Sorry, I didn't know there would be
follow up talk here. Get this on the record. The Prime Minister at the time politically made George Bush look liberal, and we had him for 16 years, and I will freely say that the only good thing he did was immediately after the Port Arthur massacre moved to take firearms away. And the one thing I will admit, like, obviously there's nothing in the Australian Constitution that speaks to the right to have firearms, because that's ridiculous.
By the way, there probably should be for you guys. Like, there's like snakes that are gonna kill you. There's like, I mean, for a place like America, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you don't have as many feral hogs as we do. That's a major issue. I'm surprised they didn't interrupt the show, to be honest with you. It's probably because Brian's out there shooting them with all his guns. No, like in a place where things actually do want to kill you all the time, which is Australia, my understanding of it is just every day a few of you die because of various animals that we've never heard of. I would almost say like that would be a place where guns might not be the worst idea. But instead, you don't have the cult around gun ownership that unfortunately we do because of some stupid words that Andrew's friends put in the Constitution. And they, anyway, okay, sorry.
No, Noah.
There was a question here from a member of the audience that did not get recorded properly. It essentially was with the news of Epstein's death. Where does this leave us in the Epstein case? So we're going to pick back up with Andrew responding to that question.
I want to say this because a number of people have expressed, and I think this is implicit in your question, something like, well, this really sucks because now there was a pending criminal indictment and there was the potential that some of his victims were going to get something approaching justice and they're not going to get that. And I agree with that. And then... You know, the kind of crazy conspiracy theorist. Is this the Clintons through the lizard people and the Illuminati shutting it down? I do want to say you know how I'm using the word positive here, right? But the positive thing is that the documents that we've talked about in the Second Circuit, the court just lifted. Virtually all of those documents were redacted or declared confidential and were held in camera by the court. The Second Circuit reversed and ruled that those documents must be made public. Those lawsuits that are in New York that are the subject of the Second Circuit's ruling are civil lawsuits, and they are civil lawsuits against Ghislaine Maxwell, who is the creepy socialite pimp, and against our friend Alan Dershowitz. And those people are still alive. Those lawsuits are still valid. So all of those documents are going to come out.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of conspiracy theory mongers. It's not going to make any difference, really, in terms... Like, the evidence was already... He was going to plead the fifth or what. Like, he's not going to testify to anything, right? And the idea that this is going to stop... Well, I guess I'll ask you. Will this make any real, tangible difference in terms of, like, you know, will X person get away with it, or will Bill Clinton get away with it?
If there are documents that implicate Alan Dershowitz or Bill Clinton or Donald Trump or anybody that is the subject of potential rumors, I don't think that Epstein's death is going to make a difference in terms of those documents coming out. The only thing that it is likely to stop is if there were additional investigatory efforts that the Second District would have to undertake. But I don't know that they would have had to, right? Like, I mean, you've got a slam dunk case against Epstein. I mean, when we covered that on the show, like the undisputed facts are horrifying, right? I mean, are worse than, you know, it is everything that the right thought was happening with Pizzagate in the basement of a pizza parlor that doesn't have a basement, right? Like it is worse. I mean, like, this guy had a private island. It's gross and awful. And so, but those documents are going to come out.
All right. Okay. All right. I don't want to have to move. Sorry.
So I worry that immigration might not be a winning issue for Democrats in the next election, and I think there's other issues that I wish there was more attention on that I think would be. But since it's front and center, how would you go about crafting legislation that would bring along conservative voters in states that we need to be in play?
Ooh, great question. And I don't know. I mean, let me talk a little bit about the predicate of that question first, right? Which is you should not be nervous as a Democrat watching the debates and watching there being a considerable amount of energy on the left for positions like abolishing ICE, right, which is not a broadly popular position, right? I think the last numbers I saw on that is that polls nationally in the 40s, right? And look, it's not as stupid as, like, let's do nothing about guns, which polls in the 10s, right? But it's probably a loser electorally if Elizabeth Warren, as the nominee on day one of the Democratic National Convention, says we're going to abolish ICE, like that, you know. But this is how, other than in 2016, this is how the political process plays out, right? The energy is sort of on the furthest voices during the primaries, and then as the candidates shape up towards the general elections, they moderate their positions in an effort to sort of win over swing voters. 2016 was really unique in that Hillary Clinton, for all of the vitriol directed at her by certain Bernie bro contingents, moved, and I know I've lost more patrons now, sorry. This part isn't going out on the air, so that's good. Moved to the left in the general election. I can't remember, in my lifetime, that has not happened with a Democratic nominee. Didn't help.
Can I jump in for a brief moment? When are we going to start, as Democrats, leading on issues rather than responding in retrospect to what we think the polls say? The Republicans, thank you. The Republicans just do the Republicans. They're like, we don't care what you think. We're going to do all the gun control. Everybody wants it. Don't care. Like, they'll just not do it. And they still do okay in the ballot box. When are Democrats going to say, oh, this issue might be 40%. Let's just get it to 50 and just do it because it's the right thing. Yeah. And make the case for it. And actually try to change opinion rather than always being on the other end of it, like behind everybody. Okay, you want to go this way, you want to go that way. It's driving me crazy lately.
Yeah, and
thank you.
That definitely deserves that. And I've said this on the show before, but I'll say it again because I think it's appropriate right here. The DLC, right, centrist third way, you know, we've lost a bunch of presidential elections. In 1992, their messaging was Democrats need to not
be anti-capital punishment because capital punishment was sort of polling in the 60s. And as a result, and Democrats did, they stopped, right? Like Bill Clinton very famously in 1992 left the campaign trail to do a photo op while Arkansas executed Ricky Ray Rector, who had an IQ, I think, of 85. I mean, he was, it was gross. And as a result of the Democrats abandoning that, right, taking a position that was, okay, 62-38, 60-40, unpopular, but you know, let's get it to 50. As a result, the support for the death penalty went from low 60s to high 70s. And in the 2000s, when you had the evidence from places like the Innocence Project that led to Republican governors in deep red states imposing moratoriums on the death penalty to make sure that, you know, we're not actually killing innocent people. There wasn't an infrastructure there, an organized infrastructure on the Democratic Party to take advantage of that. And so that's a long-winded way of saying I agree 100% with what you're saying. You've got to build your case and make your arguments, and then...
And credit to Bernie Sanders for doing that in 2016. Like, you know, we like Elizabeth Warren, but, like, I'm reminded in these debates of, you know, the things I do like about Bernie, which is he has beliefs... And he yells about him. He gets all mad and flustered about him. And then, like, that might have been more Nixon than anything. Oh, yeah, I don't. But then the poll numbers come. Like, he dramatically changed where the Democratic Party wanted to go. And it can be done. Like, we have the example not only on the right, but on the left. Yep. So, like, let's do it. So that's my way of saying, and this might not be an official OA show position, but I think we should abolish ICE. All right. What do you think? We could probably do a few more. Those stairs are terrible, so you might have to shout your question. Let's do a few more. We got time. All right. If you guys are still having fun,
shout it out.
Hi.
And I'll say it into the mic for the listeners later. Yeah.
Hey, you don't have the microphone, so you're good. Sorry. This is how I stall for time. I do this with Thomas too.
So just for the file later on, the audio, in case it didn't come through on the mic, the question is, since everybody hates Ted Cruz, I think was the premise, could a law be passed that's like, hey, yeah, Ted Cruz, let's all poke him in the eye. Can you do that?
No, you can't do
that. You can't pass a law that violates the Constitution.
Yeah. And hilariously...
But what if the Supreme Court was like, we also hate Ted Cruz?
So I'm going to go there, right? Because Ted Cruz would be saved... by the thing that he most hates, which is the substantive due process clause of the 14th Amendment, which protects basic personal liberties. And while no court has ever ruled the right not to be
poked... No, every single person's going to poke him in the eye, and we all get to yell after we each do it, but was it cruel and unusual?
But yeah, so he would be protected by the substantive due process clause, unless... Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and the Howler Monkey contingent of the Supreme Court eliminates the substantive due process clause from our jurisprudence, at which point, at least we could pass the Poke Ted Cruz Act. So, you know, so hold up those optimists right there.
He's running for human president. What else do you need to know? I'm convinced. Let's go up there. Sure, yeah.
Yeah,
it's a constitutional hardball question.
Yeah.
Should Democrats? And so for the audio, just to repeat it.
Yeah.
Should Democrats do what Republicans do and just start just breaking everything, but in a good way?
I have moved to yes on that, and
his noodle is moved.
And I'll give the answer that I gave on the show, which is. The Supreme Court has now said, to the victor go the spoils in gerrymandering, that political gerrymandering is perfectly fine. So I'm sorry, don't give money to Common Cause and support like these organizations that have been trying to get bipartisan, nonpartisan commissions to draw districts. You should in the state of New York, right, we should gerrymander the hell out of New York, right? This should be 34-1 Democratic districts.
Excellent. California. Join the dark side, Andrew Torres.
Look, they've once they say those are the rules, you're an idiot if you don't play by the same rules, right? Like, Republicans are going to gerrymander even more than they have already in the states where they can. And so I hate this. I mean, I said this on the show, too. I don't like giving this answer because it really does bother me. Like, I mean, you guys heard me talk about the Maryland case, right? Like, it is I live in Maryland. I used to be in Maryland's first congressional district, right? In the area that was added into Maryland's first congressional district. Basically, what they did is they took all the Republicans in the panhandle, right? Maryland has a huge panhandle that is all rural people. They're farmers. They're Trump supporters. And they stuck in Montgomery County, which is the wealthiest, most liberal D.C. suburb in Maryland. It's a great place to live. I used to live there. That's totally not fair to those farmers in the panhandle, right? Like, they don't have anything in common with D.C. suburbanites who live in Montgomery County. You should be able to choose your representatives instead of the other way around. But until we fix it, you know, we gotta play dirty like they do.
Well, we have until, I think, 7:15. You guys still having fun? You want to do a few more? Or all right, we still got so many questions. Let's go to this side, right over there. You, yeah. Thank you. I was going to say, next question. Yeah.
The next question, I do want to go to Thomas.
I know, you guys have never seen it. A lot of you have never seen us. Could you tell who's Thomas and who's Andrew?
It's a little bit promoting.
We both have beards. And cooking, by the way. How the hell are you doing that? Am I right?
Well, actually, my family is over here on this side of the stage. So my wife, Terry.
Hi, family.
My sister-in-law Stephanie and Blasto, who's everyone has seen and fallen in love with Blasto.
Blasto is a specimen. I did not realize Blasto is a transformer.
He is 15 months old, so he is going to get. I think he's going to triple in size. He's going to get to be 7 feet tall and about 900 pounds. Yeah, Bernice. Yep. And my son Alex over here. So.
Who I am never going to debate on anything because I do not want to look like a fool. But how do you balance all that stuff, sir? How do you do it?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, what?
My solution was quit my job. Yeah. Why don't you do that?
Well, that was kind of my solution, right? Like I one of the great things now is that. Thanks to everyone here. Like, I have two jobs. I work them around the clock, but I love both of them. And I really do. I mean, I've got to say it to everybody except one person who shall remain nameless sitting in the front row. Thank you, sincerely thank you for supporting the show, for coming out tonight, and for making it possible for me to do a thing that I love as my career. I give a speech to lawyers in which I point out that lawyers are in the top 10 in the following categories. Number one, job dissatisfaction. Number two, substance abuse. These are not jokes. And number three, least trusted among the public. As you know, we talk about the practice. It's very, very difficult to find somebody who feels fulfilled as a lawyer. People who work in public interest tend to do a lot better. I'm a happy lawyer, and that's fucking crazy, and it's thanks to you guys. So, thank you.
Yes. So for the once again for the audio impeachment, what's the status that we see a number of different impeachment proceedings, investigations? What's actually happening? Is it happening? Are we in it?
So a couple things. Number one, an impeachment inquiry is Thomas's favorite phrase.
A sternly worded letter.
It is. No, it, yeah. It absolutely is. It is a letter to the Attorney General. Right. Yeah, hisses are appropriate.
Dear Satan, how are you? Do you want to not be evil? No? Okay. We didn't think so, but we wrote this letter just in case.
Feeling fine.
TTYL.
Jerry. Yeah. And this is a case when Jerry Nadler has said there are impeachment proceedings, right? This is like the Patreon joke of it's legal, it's advice, it's not legal advice, right? Like it is there are proceedings that relates to impeachment that have to do with the subpoenas that have been issued, but it is not an impeachment proceeding, capital I, capital P. That will require a vote.
That's
of
from
the full
impeachment region of France. That's why.
That will require a full vote of the House, and then that begins the trial, and then the Senate.
Have we
sits
considered
as the
jury. Sicking Blasto on anybody who doesn't? Because like that. That's way better than a sternly worded letter. It's seeing that magnificent beast. All right. Let's see. We can fit one more, probably. Let's go up and back there. Yep, you. Favorite freedom granted. Favorite freedom. I really enjoy not quartering soldiers in my house.
Damn.
Every day, I walk into my living room. And I'm like, I bet you in a different country, I would be stuck with some soldiers being... No, I'll quarter you in my house. Wait. I don't think I want to say whatever that sentence was. You may visit anytime, Alice. You may visit anytime. Every morning I make my coffee. I'm like, I'm so glad there isn't a guy with a musket here, you know, like poking things, getting in the way. Yeah, because he would be. I mean, they just stand there, I think. Yeah, that's mine. What about you?
I can't believe Thomas took the Third Amendment. I was as soon
I
as
I pled
you,
the Third Amendment.
hilariously, Thomas's joke there, I think might be the actual answer
no,
I give. Right? The
you're Fifth supposed Amendment, to say freedom of speech.
I'm going to say the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination is something that has very few defenders these days, and it's really, really important that we remember sort of the beginning of the notion of the American criminal justice system, and that was meant to embody aphorisms like, right, it is better that 10 guilty people go free than punish one innocent person. That one of our founding myths that happened is John Adams defended the British soldiers who were charged in the Boston Massacre. That's the kind of thing this country was founded on, and those things are still important to me.
I think we have time for one final question. It better be good. Who's got it? Way all the way, way in the back. Yes, you in the back. All right. It's if Trump loses in 2020 and just says, I'm not leaving, what do we do? I think you've already answered this before. It's not realistic, but any thoughts?
Yeah. This is one of one of the things we've learned from Donald Trump is that how much of the rule of law is just pretend, right? That things count because they've always counted until all of a sudden you had a criminally insane game show host as president and they didn't count anymore. And I've said this on the show before, but I'm going to say it again because I have a microphone and you don't.
needlessly hostile.
I truly believe that something like this happened on kind of day one. Trump pulled Don McGahn and his legal advisors and said, "Hey, I want Jared Kushner." To be on the White House chief of staff, and Don McGahn said, well, that blatantly violates the anti-nepotism law. You can't do that. And then I think this is the critical moment that Trump said, yeah, but what if I do it anyway? What can they do to me? And that's a terrifying moment in our history. That I don't think Richard Nixon crossed that. I think he honestly said it doesn't matter what the law means. What matters is what happens, right? So okay, all of that's really fucking bad about Trump. But one of the bright spots is It's not like you know, the floor is lava, right? Like that Trump gets to stay president as long as he doesn't get out of the chair, and like what's granted by a piece of paper.
Elizabeth Warren might not want to occupy that White House anyway. After he's, she's like, you know, I'll be president from home. Can we work from? Like, everybody's telecommuting nowadays. Like,
but no, so you can't arrest the president while he's the president. But while he's just a guy who won't leave the Oval Office, like, you can arrest that guy, and they will.
All right. No, thank you guys so much. We are so happy you came, and this was a delight. Thank you. Selfie time. Come on, audience. Be in our selfie.
Hey, you guys, over the wings. Get in behind us.
And despite this being a live show, we do still need to do a couple things. I got to thank the new patrons. And also, you need the answer to last week's T3BE. So you kind of got a double T3T6BE. T6B2E2, I think. So we'll do that. But first, the new patrons over on patreon.com/law. We start with Thanks. That's a good name. Wake Blake, Jonathan Steele, TBA9363, Jeff Peterson, Charlotte Ratty, Trilobite Tark, Alex, Chris Adams, P. Andrew Torres, Attorney at Loud. AB, Got the Touch, You've Got the Power, Tyler Holsenbach, Susan Schutz, Byron Miller, Alice D., Dale Wesley, and Jake Adamo. Thank you so much, new patrons. We appreciate you so much. With that said, let's get back to the answer for Thursday's show. And Andrew will be joining me for that. And here we go.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
All right, it's T3BE time. It's answer time to our studio recorded question last week regarding building one structure and then getting out of the construction business. This was a tough one. What do we got, Andrew? Lay it on me.
Yeah. Okay, so this question was a contract to build three different structures on three different pieces of property, and each one had a separate price. Each structure was distinct from the other two. The builder finishes the first one and then is like, I've had it. I'm out of here. You're on the hook for the other two. And the landowner says, well, I'm not paying you anything. And the builder says, no. You're definitely paying me for the first structure. Sues. And then the question is the builder likely to prevail in a lawsuit for the agreed upon price of the first structure? You eliminated B and D?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, that's the closest I could find to elimination. Right. That was a hard one.
Yeah. So you eliminated B and D. B was no, because the builder's cessation of performance is without legal excuse, was a willful breach of the contract. That is a good elimination, and I think that was in the background. You were feeling as though contract law is not about moral dessert, right? The fact that there is a willful breach that can be considered in breach of contract cases, right? That's a real term, but it doesn't affect the recovery of damages if there is an agreed upon price, right? Like otherwise, every time you would then basically import the concept of tort damages and fault into a breach of contract case. And, you know, but in general, we don't do that. So willful breach, distractor, good elimination. Ultimately, you went with A, that substantial performance is a constructive condition of the landowner's duty to pay at the contract rate. And so therefore, no, he is not likely to prevail. And I'm sad to tell you that is incorrect. The question here is the question of substantial performance versus, as you might suspect,
divisible. Yeah.
And here, right, the fact that the parties have different obligations that are all aggregated into the same contract makes that contract divisible, right? That's what the fact goes through. And it says, look, they're each of these three things. And so then once it's divisible, again, I think you analyze this really perfectly. Once the contract is divisible, then the question is, would it require you to bring a separate claim as the landowner, or does the landowner just owe the cost to the builder of the completing the first structure, but is able within that lawsuit to offset by deducting whatever damages he might recover due to the willful breach? And that's answer D. That is the correct answer. Okay. So not only a miss, a rare failure for Thomas's second chance bar exam.
I had no, I think if there had only been one divisible answer, I think I would have gotten it. It's just those two. I had no way. Like, it's rare that I second chance miss. That rarely happens. And I think that is because I just did not have a good way to differentiate C and D besides, you know, my thought was like any recoverable damage. Who decides? So as part of this one lawsuit, would that be part of the process? Is they would go, you know, once they rule like, okay, yes, you can get the agreed upon price, but we're going to, does somebody rule on like what's a recoverable damage, or do they have to do a separate thing for that? How does that work? I don't get it.
So it works in one of two ways. Either the landowner will raise a counterclaim alleging breach of contract against the builder, or the landowner will raise as an affirmative defense the right of offset, right? And we'll say, hey, he owes me damages in connection with his behavior.
When you put it like that, doesn't that make both C and D good answers?
Well, no.
What gives you D better than C?
Well, because C says we'll be required to bring a separate claim. He is not required to bring a separate claim. It can be part of the answer, part of the affirmative defense. And again, what makes it an affirmative defense is the landowner bears the burden of proof on that, right? Now, again, this is not going to be hard to prove because all you have to prove is, what the contract. Well, let me correct myself midstream. And Brian, you know, leave that in. Don't correct that out. It will be a challenge for the landowner to show what damages are allocable to the breach of contract by the builder, right? I could certainly see plausibly the builder being like, look, I was going to build three of them. I built the first one. I'm 106 years old. I'm exhausted. I'm done. I'm not building anymore. He can hire somebody to build the other two. And in that case, right, if there are no other damages, then the only damages to which the landowner would be entitled would be the difference between the market price of getting somebody to come in and build the other two structures and the quoted price in the contract, if any. In terms of other consequential damages, you could imagine, right, but the hypothetical here says these three are on three separate pieces of property. Yeah. They're entirely distinct from the other. And so, you know, you could imagine a harder case in which, you know, you're building, this is, even though they're on three separate pieces of property, like this is the model house and the other two are the rental property, right? You know, I could imagine something where you would say you have reduced the market value of the other two properties because I'm going to have to bring somebody else in and they have a different style or whatever. But those things will be hard to prove. So let me reverse myself on the first one and say that there is a little bit of a challenge in raising those issues. And that's why you have the flexibility as the litigant to either raise it as a separate claim or just raise it as part of your defenses.
So in a way, C and D are both right, but because C kind of eliminates the possibility of the other thing,
it's C says required to bring a claim. You are not required. So C is not correct. If C says permissible, right, if C were to say, and the landowner may bring a separate claim for the builder's failure to complete the other two structures.
I hear you, but like, That's a tough one, because as a non-lawyer, when I hear, well, the landowner will be required to bring a separate claim for the builder's failure to complete the two structures, that sounds to me like it's, you're not requiring someone to bring a claim. You're just requiring them to bring a claim if they want to try to get paid back for the failure, you know, like.
Right. But they can. But the important thing is you are not required even to offset, to deduct the damages. Right. You can raise as an affirmative defense the notion of offset. So you do not have to bring a separate claim in order for that to be a litigatable issue. And look, like, this is crucial because you can, if you've just pled kind of your boilerplate affirmative defenses, it means that even if you don't file a counterclaim, that you will be entitled. So suppose the landowner is not, you know, is proceeding pro se, right? The builder sues, the landowner is just a guy and he can't afford to hire a lawyer. And so he doesn't know how to bring a counterclaim and he doesn't think about it anyway. He's still going to be entitled to discovery on the potential damages between, you know, that we've talked about as a failure of the builder's refusal to complete his obligations under the contract. And he's still going to be able to offset anything he can prove as damages arising from that breach against whatever he owes to the builder. But at the end of the day, your first instinct in analyzing this question was correct, right? The builder did a lot of work and,
yeah, I know. I would. This was a bad. Okay, I want to apologize to my many fans who are pulling for me. This was a bad answer by me. But I didn't feel great about A. I felt pretty good about the B elimination. Didn't feel great about A, but I just could not decide between C and D. I still am having a hard time understanding it. And even had I gone with C or D, I probably would have gone for C. So like, I was nowhere near this one. So you know. I got to go back to the books. I got to study up, got a training montage. And for me, that means not doing that because I'm not a lawyer. But all you lawyers out there, hit the books. all right. That was a failure, but I think that was one of the hardest questions I've had, to be honest. I don't know how I would have been able to figure all that out on my own. But who knows? Maybe I need to expect more from myself. let's go to the limited use time machine to find out who our big winner of this week's T3B.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
This week's recipients for Never Ending Fame and Fortune goes to all the wonderful people that came out to the live show in New York City. Thanks for coming. It was great meeting you all.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed all the content from the live show and the as well as the new bar exam and all that. We hope you can make the next live show. If you can't, That's okay. But if you can, you need to take advantage of it because it was a great time. And some of the stuff was for live show ears only. So there you have it. It's lost to the ether. So we'll see everybody, though, for a rapid response Friday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.
So I'm really tempted by necromancers.